Do it till 9:30. Okay. Again, I'm Vivian. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Vivian.
Okay, you guys are going to find this hard to believe, but except for the people who've known me for a long time, like Michael B. over there, every once in a while, I'll get people who know me a long time. I have been abstaining from eating sugar. I am a terrible sugar addict. I couldn't go a day without eating sugar. A day at a time. My abstinence is sugar has to be the fourth ingredient or more on the label. And I ask everybody, if I don't know, I'm like label, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, where I ask people. So I've been doing that a day at a time for 40 years. So if you think, oh, this can't be done, or it's a flash in the pan, I'm at least one person who tells you it can be done for a really long time, and someone who is completely addicted to sugar. And that is, in fact, one of the secrets for getting this program, is saying, you know what, I really 100% have this problem. People who think like, oh, I have a 10%, they come and they go. I knew that I had a horrible problem with this. I have been eating, I mean, to tell you my story, I've been eating compulsively ever since I can remember. I can remember, we were living in New York City, so I know I was under 7 years old, and I was watching TV at 6 a.m, as you do when you're little. You get up, you know, super early, and you're like, adults are so boring. Why are they always in bed? It's such a boring place. So at 6 a.m, the TV would go on, because it didn't used to be that there were always programs. It started at 6 a.m. So we get there, sit in front of the TV, and I wasn't allowed to wake up my mom until 7. So I'd have on the left-hand side of me was a bottle of kosher dill pickles. And on the right-hand side was a bag of Wise potato chips, very salty. And I would just go, you know, crunch, 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 and zone out, just zone out. That's what food does for me. That's what eating does for me, is it takes me out of reality, which I find so frightening, and puts me into the movie in my head, and just... yeah, it cushions me from the rest of the world. And sugar was, I mean, then I was eating that, that's true, but sugar was, turned out to be like the worst. I whenever we went to a restaurant, you know, I check out the dessert menu. When I came here, I was about 20 pounds heavier than this too, I think it's important to say. And that was 40 years ago. So I would have just kept getting heavier and heavier and heavier. Because our disease is progressive. It doesn't get better, as it explains in the Big Book, which is written by the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson, and he had input from some of the first people in the group, but mostly by him. And he just hit our disease on the head. It just gets worse as time goes on. So I was 20 pounds heavier then. I would have been many, many more pounds heavier, and I probably would not have wanted to continue living, because I just felt so awful about myself. I used to walk through alleyways so that people wouldn't see what I looked like. I didn't wear blue jeans for years. I didn't wear blue jeans coming in here. I hadn't worn a bathing suit in years. I remember when I first got to OA, they had somebody started OA on the beach, so that you could get used to wearing a bathing suit. It was not, you know, it was fantastic. It was like not even funny. It was fantastic, because I went, like, I hadn't worn a bathing suit in centuries. Like, I used to wear, in the middle of like a July day, long jackets, anything. Like, I didn't care what the weather was like. I was just always trying to cover up my body, and obsessed with how do people stay thin. Couldn't understand it. So when I got to this program, hello, front row person. People who sit in the front row do well. So I got here just by, I came to the Mecca of 12-step programs, Los Angeles, which I was lucky, really lucky, because I was born in New York, went to school in Washington, D.C., but I have a travel bug. I can travel anywhere, even alone, and it doesn't bother me at all. It's not frightening to me. I just buy the ticket, and then when I go, I go. And I had gone to school in London for a year for my junior year abroad, and I met someone there who was from Los Angeles. So I came to visit her as my senior year graduation present. My parents were like, what would you like? I go, I'd like to visit my friend Leanne in LA. Fine. So I came out here and I didn't think I would like it here. I had like a New Yorker's preconception of LA, thinking like, everyone here is nuts. You must be from New York. Everyone here is nuts. They're all like on Venice Beach with that guy that juggles the chainsaws. And then don't they know that big ones come in? They're all going to die of an earthquake. What are they even staying there for? What a bunch of nuts. So, but I watched the Johnny Carson show and think, why are you guys still there? But at any rate, I came to see her. I came to sneer at everyone. And just like with maybe with the program for a lot of people, you come to sneer and then you stay to pray. Like within an hour, I liked it here because whatever you want to do here is fine. There's no judgment. Like in New York, you can do whatever you want, but they know you're crazy. Like here, nobody thinks you're crazy, no matter what you do. So I love the freedom of that. I moved here and again, I had this because I didn't have to stay in Washington, D.C. I would say that I was 20 pounds heavier at the time. So I was, and I started work. Work to me was really hard. I was really good at school and I was terrified of going to work. Unlike some people are the opposite. They want to go work and they don't want school. Whew, not me. I wanted to be at school forever because I know what to do there. You sit in the front row, you study, or you know, not even study so hard. You do well. But once you get out there, I have no idea. So I got my first job where it was one of these crazy jobs you get when you're, you know, like in a crazy place where they didn't even care what time I came in. It was really my job just to call the phone company and tell, I was working at a cable TV company. Then cable TV companies were like a big thing and they were tiny. They weren't like, you know, Time Warner or this or that. They were like, every municipality made somebody win it. So there were all these tiny little companies and everybody hated their cable company because everything was always not working. So the phone lines were always getting busted up and like I knew the phone guy. We used to go to lunch like on a one-on-one basis. And somebody who worked there, her name was Barbara Z, she was in this program. And she was a 100-pounder, and she was the funniest person. She was really smart, really funny. I just recently saw the movie Popeye that Robert Altman did because she's in it. And I was like, oh my God, my Barbara. Like, I haven't seen her in so long. And she asked me one day to go on, she said, hi, we were friends. How would you like to go to an AA dance? And I thought, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous dance? Like, absolutely. Like that just sounded like so freaky. And I always wanted to have experiences. I just always wanted to feel like I was living life. So I just imagined, you know, a bare light bulb and a bunch of men in raincoats circling around the light bulb in a room about this size. And so I went to this AA dance and I met, you know, an alcoholic there. He took me to meetings and then he said, he poked me, we started dating, he poked me in the hips and he goes, you need to go to OA. Everyone always says, oh, but I was so like blanketed from the food and not feeling feelings. Like I never felt anything as soon as you hurt me. I felt it later. I'd be like crying and I didn't know why. I couldn't remember why. I couldn't figure it out. And I was just like really? Like, and he goes, yeah. And I knew Barbara went to OA and she didn't think I needed to go because she thought I needed to lose. People only went to OA if they needed to lose a lot of weight. So she couldn't see it in me. But I went to my first meeting and I identified absolutely. First of all, it was sort of a joke on poor people in OA. It was in a nursery school. So these tiny little chairs like everywhere for all the people trying not to eat. But I remember my first share was that I would eat my way through grocery stores. And I thought that, I didn't think that was stealing. I thought that was economizing. Like, I would just, and at that point, like they're always trying to find out ways to cover up sugar because everyone loves sugar, but everyone feels guilty about eating it because it's well known now that it rots your teeth. It's, you know, gives you diabetes, blah, blah, blah. So they're always putting new names on it. And the new name this time was put it in a big barrel, cover it with yogurt and call them like yogurt raisins or not even chocolate. So Greg could have had it. Carob raisins, but they were just big barrels of sugary raisins. But so I was eating that, like, you know, it came with a scoop. So They were asking for it. And I would just go around the place and eat lunch or dinner or whatever, because I wasn't making any money when I got here. So I got Barbara as, I eventually got Barbara as my sponsor, because she finally saw me. We were at a table once, and there was this really ugly raisin pie or something, and it had been sitting there for like an hour and a half, and it was really dried out and looked horrible, but I just couldn't stand that it was there. I couldn't stand it anymore. She got up and went to the bathroom, which she got back, it was gone. She's like, what happened to that thing? I go, I ate it. She goes, you are one of us. I to this day, I feel like I never waste food. I feel like I will save you. You have not lived in vain. You will not go to the garbage. Don't you worry. Like, I've eaten, like, I go home, look at the refrigerator. What's about to spoil? I'm eating you. So I started on my journey here. I got a sponsor, and the 12 steps that were read, which Eileen and Jessica, this is what they told me to do for this eating program, which to me was like, this is nuts. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives would become unmanageable. Came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will over to the care of God as we understood him. That's just the first three. But I did think, at least this isn't a diet I've tried. I had tried everything. I had tried diet pills, and I was saving up money to go to one of those, the Golden Door, where they like lock you in. So like one of these health spas, if the door is open, forget it. You know, they would have to lock me in to lose weight. I would buy clothes that were too small for me. I read a lot of magazines where people were skinny, trying to see if I was motivated. I tried starving myself, but I'd always come up with a strange, like they talk in here about our mind, how our mind is nuts, like a strange mental blank spot, and how a trivial reason will get us to eat. Like I would think, I'm not going to eat today. I'm just going to starve myself. And then I would suddenly remember something like a comet coming into my head. Like I hadn't thought of that. And then I would be off eating. And then I'd be like, and it would be like 11 a.m. That's like, I couldn't even make it. So some people can make it for more than a day and they think they're not compulsive overeaters. That doesn't tell you anything, but it told me that it convinced me faster. Like I can't even make it 24 hours. So I did what they said, because I am a good student. To me, this is like school. This is a course, except I forget it every day, so I have to keep coming back. So my sponsor said, why don't you pray to God? I was like, and I was an agnostic, what they call an agnostic in here, which means you don't not believe in God, you don't do believe in God, you're like, I don't know, and I don't want to talk about it anymore. And she said, I'll just act as if you're praying to God. And I was like, Barbara, wouldn't that be, that's hypocritical. She goes, we call it acting as if. And I was like, all right. You know, I felt even embarrassed saying it out loud to myself. And I remember walking into Cafe Casino, which was a place in Westwood, if anyone knows that, that had very healthy food, but they also, they were like European. They had a big pastry case. Yes. And I walked in there, and I think I had like, you know, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks of abstinence. So at that point, you think to yourself, I can give it up. Who cares? But I did what she asked. She said, pray to God. So I said, God, please help me to not eat sugar or something like that. Even embarrassed saying it to myself. And I didn't feel this white bolt of lightning or anything like that, but I ended up walking out. I ended up walking out of Cafe Casino, and that proved to be the turning point. That started my abstinence of 40 years. So with all that, from this base of working this program and making amends and doing all of this, everything in my life has gotten better. Everything in my life is connected to, my food stopped me from living life. It stopped me from being myself. It stopped me from doing what I wanted to do. It stopped me from having a good relationship with my parents. I used to have, with friends, I'd have like conversations in my head, and then I'd be mad when I saw them because of what they did in my dream, in my, waking dream in my head. So it just, work, like I told you, I'm going to work anytime I want to call the phone company. I had a degree from Georgetown University, and this is what I was doing. So everything was lived at a not not the level that God would want me to live. And from doing this program, everything has gotten better. And I have to say that the things that I gave to God first are the things that have gone the best, because I've had the most time to get better. The first one was my job. My sponsor said to me, "Vivian, you're a terrible employee. You get everywhere. You get there late every day, and you're always complaining." And I was like, "Oh!" And she's my best sponsor. I have to say, looking back these many years, she was the toughest on me, and she changed me for the best, the most. So I try to be a tough sponsor, because it's just really people that let me slide. I didn't grow as much. So she said to me, "I want you to get there on time and smile the whole day." I was like, "That all looks so fake." She goes, "Practice in the mirror." I was like, she had no mercy. And so I did, because I was willing to give it to God. As it turned out, you would think with all, I tried so hard to get good grades, that I would have thought that I would have cared more and wanted to control work, but it didn't turn out that way. I was like, all right, you know, and I hate getting places early. And the program has taught me to get places on time. I was always late, like forever late. It's not my natural bend. I really want to sleep all day and get up late. Stay up all night, sleep late. That's really, you know, my internal clock. Thank you. So I did what she said, and then they had things called Xerox machines. So it was like this big machine, because there was no, it was a way to make copies. Okay, so they still had like primitive computers. There was a word processor person that they called, like blah, 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 doing like this. But my boss, even though I had graduated with a degree, I was still like, you know, doing all this administrative stuff. So my boss would be like, "Here, take this and Xerox 20 copies." So at first, before she gave me this direction, I'd be like, I would read it and go, "You're a moron. I am so much smarter than you. Like, I should have your job." But on the other hand, I think, "But please don't give it to me, because I'm afraid I can't do it." So I had this whole dichotomy of, I think I'm so smart and I have no confidence in myself. Like overarching, like too much self-confidence. Like, did I really know as much as my boss? Of course not. And I thought I could do nothing. Like, that was too little. Everything was off. So after she told me, "You have to smile," I went, "I'd love to." And I took the paper and I ran over to the Xerox machine and I put it like exactly on the corner without moving it, so that it wouldn't give you a smudgy copy. And I'd make the 20 copies really fast. I go, "Good job." And I pat myself on the back. And then I brought it to him, or her, because later my bosses were women. But I used to do this with everyone. "Here." And do you know that 9 months later, my two bosses called me into their office and they said, "Vivian, we never usually do this, but we have a discretionary fund for if we want to give bonuses to people, and you are such a good employee that we want to give you a $2,000 bonus." You guys, I was making, this was in like 1983 or 4, I was making like $14,000 a year. Like, $2,000 was tremendous. This was the power of giving it over to God. Every time, and when I had, you see, how I gave it over to God was I took sponsor direction. I didn't do my will anymore. I feel like God works through this program. I think God loves this program. I think God gave us like another Bible here. Like, here, do this. If you didn't understand the King James or the Talmud or whatever, try this. It's really easy. I've gotten better and better jobs ever since that. And even today, that I think probably work is it's definitely one of my best areas. So lots of, although even romantic relationships, I don't have time for that now, but even that has gone well by giving it to God. When I didn't give it to God, it was a disaster. Disaster, disaster, couldn't figure it out. It was everything that I've given to God has turned out well and turned out right. So thank you for letting me share. Okay, there is no break at this meeting. The LA Intergroup requests that you continue to contribute. as we still have operating expenses, including the subscription cost to this service? No.
No.
We still have operating expenses. We have to rent this room. Please donate to oalaig.org for a direct link to our PayPal account and specify you're supporting Kitchen Sink. Any amount is appreciated. And 12 traditions are going to be read, yay, by Nancy. Yes. Thank you. It's way in the back here.
I gotta hold it in.
Oh, there is. Awesome.
Fresh.
Okay.
Hi, Nancy from Book of Over Here.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy. 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is the desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any religious facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you. This is the time for questions only. There's like 20 minutes for questions. There's no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader, which is me, are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. If you asked a question last week, please wait until the first three questions have been asked before raising your hand. And that's it. Who would like to raise their hand and start? Yay!
Thank you. Could you go into a little bit more detail about about the romantic relationships? And
oh, yes. I would love to. Okay. This is, everybody wants to hear this. You know what? I know. Here, I'm going to, I just laid back and I crossed my legs for people who are listening to this podcast. So, okay. I was somebody who kept trying to make relationships happen. Like, I would be the chaser. And I would, and I'm straight if that matters. I don't know if it does or not, but there you go. It never worked for me to, and it was something I thought that I always needed. But it didn't work for me initiating all the time. And I never knew what had happened. I felt like I was hit by a train every time. I felt like I met you, I know the beginning. It was like there's supposed to be a beginning, middle, and end to every story. I felt like I knew where the beginning was, we met. The middle, no idea. I have no idea why this changed, why we would meet each other and it was like, I'd feel like, oh, we're in love, it's kismet. I'm like, I'm the type of person that attracts a lot of like romance and rah, like this, like high emotion. Well, that's actually sounded bad. It's not. It was really like, oh, like that. Between both of us. But it was all really fake because we didn't know each other. And so we would be like really together and then I would take off the days in the calendar and X them out and thinking, we made it like, 7 days. Yay. Like I didn't even know how to make it last. The whole thing was a mystery to me. And then one day they would break up with me usually, and I couldn't figure out why, what happened, you know? And I never learned a thing from it. It just happened over and over and over and over. And then one day, I don't remember if it was my sponsor or myself, said to me, like, you know, Vivian, you couldn't do any worse. God couldn't do any worse a job than you had. God couldn't do, it would be hard. God couldn't do any worse a job than you had. And I thought, why don't I give him a year? See how he does. So I decided to, I joined another program. I joined Al-Anon, which I credit for 100% turning me around. And I worked it like I worked this program. And of course, I didn't switch programs. I always maintained my Overeaters Anonymous program, always have sponsees, always had have a sponsor. Anyway, God worked through me through this other program where I was, I started doing things differently. I also did a sex inventory as outlined in the big book. And I saw my pattern of always dating guys that were 10 years younger than me and having sex way too fast and dating like big pink elephants in the room, like they were gay. They were moving to another continent. That happened twice. What are the odds? And we would get together just before that. It's like, I knew exactly how to not make it happen, but not consciously. It was all unconscious. So in the end, it says to give you your sexual ideal based on this. And it's basically the opposite of what you've been doing. So first of all, I had to stop sleeping with them so fast. It's like, we are not going to sleep together until 3 months have gone by. Why? Because it takes about 3-4 months to fall in love. It's just like a recipe. It just takes that long. And I kept trying to put it in the microwave and blitz it. But that doesn't work. It doesn't work with peer friendships either. Like doing something really, really fast. I experimented with that. It doesn't work. You got to start slowly and build on. Anyway, so no sleeping for 3 months. He had to ask for it to be exclusive. He had to ask, not me. I was amazed that they would do this. So it was like trying this whole new way. I didn't even think it would work, but it did. And then we had to be in love. Okay, so, because when I have sex with whoever, I put on LSD glasses and I can't see what's happening. I can't see who you are. I don't know what you're doing. All I know is we have to stay together. So the fact that I didn't sleep with them was a big deal. So we wouldn't go to like to my house or his house. That's death. I mean, you have to be in a, right? You have to be in a public place where, you know, the date was over and I was told, so I had a sponsor for this too. I'm a big believer in sponsor direction. And if I see somebody that knows how, you used to be like me and now has what I want, I'll do it. And I have that same problem and I can't get over it. I'll do whatever the hell you say. I know how to get a good teacher. That's a good teacher. I will kill to get in that class. So she said, like the first date, just like an hour and then leave. And I was like, okay. And she was like, and don't pay for anything either. Because with one guy, when this was when my late husband died, I had to do it again. My late husband died and I had screwed it up by not working a program around it. And I paid for too many. She goes, you paid for expensive vacations and expensive dinners. Don't do that. Like, just be on, he pays for everything. And if he's at the valet and he doesn't have a dollar, you left your purse at home. And it's like, aye. So I did that. I did a couple times. I did it because, as I've just alluded to, I was a widow. First I got married, I met my, so my, and also God puts people in your life, in my life anyway. My first husband, he called me back. We had 2 dates where I gave him 3 tries too, because I was big on like, oh, if it doesn't happen at first, it's not there. No, that was like an old idea. Give him 3 tries. So the first 2 times I went out with my late husband, I was like, eh, I don't know. I thought, but you know, I'd give him a 3rd try. And on the 3rd, because that was my rule, on my new rule. On the third try, he was opening doors for me. He was taking out my chairs, and he was being such a gentleman. I started to like him. You know, if I would have X'd him out from the first time, I never would have married him. And in fact, he called me later to ask me out, and he said, if you don't call me back, I will call you back. So I thought, all right, he'll call me back. I had changed. Like, God took out that whole thing of me of having to do it myself. I really gave it to God. I was like, all right. And he didn't call back. So I was like, oh, look at that. That's what happened in the experiment. He didn't call back. Yeah, I didn't even care. It was just, like, interesting. Like, oh. And do you know what? Later on, I ended up seeing him at a party. And he, because that's a God thing. So he came up to me and he said, I called you. Why didn't you call me back? I go, because you said if I didn't call you back, you'd call me back. He goes, oh, yeah, I did say that. I forgot. And so do you want to go out? Yeah, okay. So God puts people in. Even if I just let myself, let God do for me what I can't do for myself, which by these simple rules, I was keeping God out without knowing it. And when I stopped doing all that, that's when things started to happen. And then my late husband died, and then I had to do it all. I had to learn it all over again. Do you know I had to do the exact same thing all over again, and it worked twice. So not always, not like one by one. Like, it wasn't like the first person I saw. Still, you have to go through. I mean, romance is hard. You have to go through a lot of people. So when you finally, and they have to, you have to really like each other in the end, because otherwise you don't have the gumption to like stay there. But when you do, it's worth it. It's worth it. So that's what I did.
How have you navigated relationships with normies who are not in program like we are?
Oh, I mean, neither my husband's in program. I just know that I have to be with someone who is not against me going to program, period. If they're against it, they are out. I don't care if they look like Joe Mangione or whoever that guy was that I saw the other day. I was like, wow, that was a handsome guy. But it doesn't matter. The absolute most important thing in my life is recovery from this disease. So that's number one. He doesn't have to understand it. My first husband understood more that I get, I'm a nicer person when I come home. For some reason, my current husband doesn't really get that. But, you know, I go out and do stuff, and I stand up for myself. Like, I need alone time, too. Like, I'm somebody who needs alone time. And there's been times when he's been unemployed, and I'm like, you know what? You can't be at the house every time I come home. You need office hours. Like, I need 4 hours where I know you're not going to be here. I need to come home to an empty house. So, you know, I can't be always coming home and somebody's there. It drives me up the wall. It's the same thing with program. I just sit down, like, this is what I'm doing. And when he says something dumb, like, you don't have to go to the meeting, I'm like, shut up. And I just go to the meeting. But basically, that's it. I mean, if you were really against it, I wouldn't be with him. He says these things saying, sometimes normies think they're saying this and it's like saying they love you or, you know, I care about you. And I interpret it as you're just an obstruction and you're irritating me. But I have to take care of my own recovery. So it's my responsibility to go to the meeting. It's not his. And I can always leave. My hands aren't cuffed. I'm not in a cage. You know, like, so I just do what I need to do. And he doesn't know how lucky he is. Or else we would be like split and I would be unhappy too. Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question. So as far as relationships, how do you navigate like between, I think on the one hand, like the big book teaches us, you know, look out for selfishness, like where you're trying to control people, things, or circumstances. Do you find yourself, like in relationships, because of that, like personal accountability, letting things go, and therefore, like things work out, or is it helping you, like set boundaries? Because that's something I've sort of like struggled with. Like, am I supposed to be setting a boundary right now, or am I supposed to be like not? Because, you know, I'm supposed to let it go because I somehow, you know, I'm trying to control the situation.
Okay, should I repeat these questions? Okay, so it was asked for relationships, how do you tell the difference between needing to set a boundary and trying to control something and just letting things go and you know, letting it be and letting it go on as it was? Okay, I'm going to tell you something. I work these things out, what I don't know what to do, on a case-by-case basis with my sponsor. That's the secret. Because everything is different. Each little individual situation is different. And my sponsor, just like when I sponsor people, I have experience, but I'm not you involved in it. I have much more ability to see what's going on. Same thing with my sponsor. And I pick sponsors who I know are very smart. You know, they know what's going on. They have good, all you need to do, even when I had no time at all, I could hear who made sense and who sounded nuts. So you pick somebody who you're like, okay, this person is really wise. And I'm just going to, I'm going to do what they say because I want to change. And so if there's anything that I have a question about, that's what I ask her about. I've also done, sometimes I know, like, I am definitely a controlling type. And I've done experiments lately. If I do my my phone for an hour, and I try not to tell my husband what to do. And I've been lucky the last two times I did it, because we watched a couple of shows, and I picked one that both of us liked, and then nothing happened. I think I told him to get his elbow out of my leg once. That was it. And the other time we fell asleep, so I have to do it again. But I'm thinking breakfast time would really be a tough one. But it's just something that there's no perfection in it. But when I have, but I know that I used to think I was being like a good wife or a good friend if I got all in your business, and I didn't know how to set all in your good business for good, like trying to make you into a better person. Now I know that that's none of my business. That's God's business. It's like your business, my business, none of my business, God's business. So I know I'm not supposed to do that. That's huge, just knowing that, because I didn't know that before. And I make amends when I'm wrong, which can be often. Sometimes I get so mad at my husband that I'll like stick my fingernails in him. And I feel like it's a victory when I just like scratch the air in front of him because I'm not touching him. Like that is progress. Sometimes he makes me so mad. But that's not his fault. He's a very mild-mannered guy. I'm just a really, you can see how I am. I'm just like very, like I have a lot of energy and I go from 0 to 100 and faster than a Ferrari. So you know, I'm lucky that fortunate that I picked milder guys that are sort of amused by this and don't get all upset like I would.
Hi, thank you for your share. You mentioned that at the beginning you acted as if, even if you didn't believe in it. So how has your relationship with your higher power, or are you still acting as if, or what's your relationship like today?
Okay, the question was, at the beginning, I acted as if with my higher power because I didn't believe anything. In fact, I was told the group has more power than you do alone. Do you believe that the group is more powerful than you? I was like, yes, everybody in this room wants me to be abstinent, so yes, they do. And she said, how has that changed? I tell you, it's changed, you know, it's done a 180, like completely, because I treated it like, again, a scientific experiment. Let's try praying or not praying. I encourage anyone to try that experiment. Try prayer and not prayer. So I remember the first time I tried prayer was, I was still working at the place with Barbara Z, who brought me to my first meeting, the 100 pounder, and I got angry at someone there, upset, and I've never known how to handle those feelings. I didn't know how to talk about something that made me upset. I don't think that my parents' generation was taught any of that. I mean, I think it was extraordinary, like a gift. It would be like an internal gift if someone knew how to do that. But now it's more widely known how to do this. Anyway, I decided to pray over it. I'm going to, you know, I'm really upset with this, I think it was a guy, about something at work. And so I talked to him about it. I prayed and I talked to him about it, and it went well. I remember us talking in the parking lot, and it went well. And usually things like this, I would ignore. They would not go well. And I thought, okay, that's one for prayer. You know, it actually went well. And I just kept doing things like this. And then when I would try not praying, and that didn't go so well. And it was like, if this is not loaded dice, you know, then if there was maybe not a God, it would be like 50-50. If you did this all the time, praying and not praying, and you had the same results, then it would be like, I don't know if there's a God. But if when I pray, way more times things happen, then I believe there's a God. And I'm able to see more times that God has removed things in my life. Like when my late husband died, my sponsor at the time, I was feeling like I wanted to quit work and go into a sanitarium. I was so knocked out, and I stayed abstinent through the whole thing, but at one point I lost 10 pounds without even knowing it, and then I gained it back without knowing it, you know, but I was abstinent, but I didn't want to. I would pass this hospital of, like, not a big one, but one where you could see the beds inside, like a sanitarium, and I would look at it longingly because I thought, oh, I wish I just could go underneath the covers and somebody just take care of things for me. And I asked my sponsor, like, I think I should go on medication. And she's like, well, you can do that, but I wouldn't be able to sponsor you because I don't have any experience with it. And I went, oh, she goes, why don't you go to more meetings and rely on God? And I was like, oh my God. I didn't want to, I was like, is this always the solution they give? And don't you realize how big my problem is? But I did not want to lose her as a sponsor, so I did it. And, you know, 2.5 weeks, I went to more meetings. I went to more meetings, and I just dragged myself. I could barely breathe. Breathing, by the way, is involuntary. You know, even you don't have to think to breathe. If I had to think to breathe, I would have stopped breathing. That's how little energy I had. And at the end of 2.5 weeks, that incredibly indescribable feeling of anger and pain was lifted. God lifted it. And I never took any antidepressants. I never took anything. God lifted it from me taking my sponsor's direction. And that's just one, that's a one big example, but of, like, you know, God entering my life. It was just like, I can't argue with that. It's never come back. This is many years ago. He died in 2005. Many years. So thank you for letting me share. Oh, 5 minutes. Oh,
we can do one more if you want. Okay, we'll restart the thing.
Yeah.
Hang on. Go ahead.
I loved everything you said, and I wanted to see if you'd like to come to our meeting again.
I would
like
come
every week.
Oh, every week. You heard me say I'm a night person. Like, this was like, I'm happy to come and speak, and, you know, come, I don't know, twice a year maybe. But I hate getting up early. I hate it. I feel like the whole world is run by people who get up early. Yes, Michael.
So,
but thank you. I love you for asking that question.
Did you sponsor her and make her do that? So I'm curious about balance in your life and work and stuff. I'm on the cusp of retirement, maybe, and I'm afraid because I don't want to get lazy and I can stay in bed forever. So I don't know whether you're working now. If you're not, how do you make lists to balance your time and being comfortable and serene?
Okay, this is great because I did go through this. So the question is, he's on the verge of retirement. He doesn't want to get lazy and stay in bed all day. Like, what do you do once you retire? This is supposed to be a great time. So I left advertising when my late husband died. I was working 60 hours a week for many years. And I actually had two sponsors tell me to quit my job. I used to work so much. They were like, you don't own the place. You need to get put program first. You need to quit. And I did. So, but this time, my husband had owned part of a business. He left me enough money that I could actually start a new life where I could, like, volunteer. So I quit my job, just like you're retiring, and I thought, I had always thought that what I would do was I would give tours, docent tours for museums. So I tried that, and I had actually sort of been doing it beforehand, but they didn't have enough tours during the week, and I found I'd been doing it so long I didn't like it anymore. So I didn't do that, and then somebody said to me, so this is like a year or something goes by, and then I got a new puppy, and he's a really sweet, calm, mellow dog, and trainer said to me, you should have him be a therapy service dog, but he's just got it in, and so I thought, this is what I'll do. I'll bring my dog to hospitals. And he passed all these tests, and we did that for 2 years. We went to Kaiser, we went to Good Samaritan downtown, but I found I didn't like it. You know, I don't like seeing all these old people. It's mostly old people. When I turn old, I'll be like, okay, who likes old people? Because, you know, somebody likes old people, help me out. But so I did it for 2 years. And I was like, I didn't like it anymore. So I didn't know what to do. And you know what happened? It happened. My job is now, I sponsor a lot of people. I don't know why it took me so long to think of this. I just really increased the amount of people that I sponsor. That's like my job. We had to move from, it was my choice, we moved from Mandeville Canyon because there are fires over there, and the last time there was a fire, I was really, 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 really scared, and I was listening for the wind, I got like PTSD, so now we moved onto concrete, but it was a fixer house, and I'm still fixing it, so I'm doing that, and I also bought residential real estate, and so I'm a manager of that, so I do the managing of that, and you know, when I finally, years from now, finish the house, I'll have to have more time with people in program. I'll have to really meet people and see them for lunch, and you know, do more things like that. But between managing the real estate and having, so I have 11 sponsees now, and 3 of them are new. New people take a lot of time. Like older people, not so much. Well, sometimes they do. Actually, I got an old person she wants to talk a lot, like a lot of detail. The same thing every week. But that's what I do. And it took a while. It took years for me figuring it out. But I kept at it. Thanks. And thank you for letting me share.